This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Oh, there's a lot to break down in the trial of Karen Reed as we're about to get into week three of the trial. Lots has happened and there are a lot of things to come. Joining me to discuss, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor. Yeah, we're still in the prosecution's case right now. Of course, we're seeing a lot of very interesting cross with several of the witnesses. Let's just start from the prosecution standpoint before we start looking at some of the clips. What's been your take on how things have been going for them?
Prosecution from the first trial has really beefed up their presentation. They've sort of done it in a refined way. They're showing clips of Karen Reed's statements after different witnesses, which sort of show inconsistencies and discrepancies. And on top of that, they beefed up their cell phone expert, which scored them some points in terms of where John O'Keefe's cell phone likely would have been during this series of events.
And there was a lot of, let's start with the cell phone data, because that was an interesting one. Of course, you have one expert saying this is what we found. We dug deeper into the data. It got kind of technical for a little bit, but I think he ended up spelling it out with some graphics for the jury pretty well, even going as far as actually demonstrating in court how the 225 How's Long to Die in Cold was actually at 6-something based on the browser history and the tabs and all the technicalities in that. That, you know, it's a couple steps. Do you think it landed well with the jury, as this is factual, this is data, this is not up for debate, no matter how much the defense is going to say, well, our guy says this.
Yeah, you know, when we're talking about scientific data and scientific analysis, forensic analysis, sometimes that can get confusing. And so you really got to, put it in simple terms for the jury. I think demonstrations are almost always helpful. And they've really sort of explained how, even though, you know, the browser tab was opened around 2 a.m. or so, the search, according to the prosecution, wasn't conducted until 6 a.m. And that really lines up with the prosecution's theory and undermines this defense conspiracy.
It really does. Let's watch a clip of Ian, who was the Cellebrite expert, talking about just this and talking about not only that, but we're going to watch about the other linchpin here, the temperature of that cell phone, and we'll talk here.
And again, at 36 minutes and 40 seconds, two more phone calls received from Karen, again showing unanswered calls and resulting in pocket state being recorded by Doppler function. 37 minutes past midnight, battery temperatures dropped to 72 Fahrenheit. And at 37 minutes and 8 seconds, a further phone call, again unanswered, again resulting in a pocket state recorded by Doppler. 37 minutes and 31 seconds, a 3-second voicemail received from Karen. And at 38 minutes and 21 seconds, another incoming call. And at 38 minutes and 26 seconds, another incoming call, both unanswered, both resulting in Doppler pocket state being detected by Doppler. And I've also shown some of the locations that were recorded at around this time by the device. 40 minutes and 31 seconds, a message received from Jennifer McCabe saying, hello. This is the first iMessage or SMS message received by the device, which is unread. This is followed up 2 minutes later, 42 minutes and 9 seconds, by another message from Jennifer McCabe saying, where are you? And at 42 minutes and 35 seconds, there's a 40-second voicemail received from Karen. 43 minutes past midnight, the battery temperature has now dropped to 66 degrees Fahrenheit. At 45 minutes and 53 seconds, another incoming message from Jennifer McCabe saying hello. And again, we can see location data at 53 minutes and 7 seconds, placing the device on the front yard somewhere, kind of around the flagpole area. 55 minutes and 31 seconds, a message received from Karen stating, I'm going home. 55 minutes and 50 seconds, a follow-up message saying, see you later. another location data. This is the location that's shown bottom left. And at 2 minutes past 1 a.m., another message from Karen saying your kids are cooking alone.
So we got cell phone data that shows where he is. And it also shows the temperature of his phone. And that, it's going to take, I don't know, it's going to take a little magic, I think, to have that be completely explained by the defense of Karen Reed, because Karen's own angry calls are what actually pinpoints John's location. Her obsessive calling are what show us fairly definitively where he's at over and over and over. That's why there's so many dots on the picture that he didn't show it in that one, but there is one where he shows the dots of where the cell phone is pinging from, and they're all in the front yard, and it's all because of Karen's. Good job, Karen. And the also, so let's talk about that first. Karen's own calls are doing this and showing where he is located. Just that alone, before we talk about temperature, how do you think the jury's reading that?
No, I think it could be interpreted as kind of poetic irony.
Yes,
she's the one who's being charged with these crimes, and her calls, according to the government, are what identify the alleged victim being outside the house the whole time. You know, probably freezing to death, or at least experiencing serious cold. And so that's kind of an interesting way that, that played out. I think the defense is going to say that those calls show Karen didn't know whether she hit John O'Keefe or not, because if she had known, you know, why continue to call? Why continue to ask where he is? That kind of thing.
Sure. The temperature data also, you have McCabe texting him, wondering where her friend is at. And that also shows he's outside, and it also shows the phone is cold. So we can't argue that, oh, he's in the house and it's all a ruse. No, the phone's cold. It's outside. When she's texting him those things. So he's not in the house. Why would she be texting if he was in the house? Where are you at? It's a fairly small gathering in a fairly small area. There's no question if he would have been in there or not. That also goes to the prosecution's theory of everything that happened, and it makes sense.
Yeah, it certainly does when looked at through that lens. If Jen McCabe was in the house, it wouldn't make sense for her to be texting, where are you, if John O'Keefe was also there? And then the phone temperature indicates, according to the government, that the phone stayed outside the whole time, which means John O'Keefe never went in the house. That's a tremendous problem for the defense. That's really what they're hanging their hat on in terms of trying to get Karen Reed's innocence vindicated, is that John O'Keefe went into the house and there was this fatal event. But if the phone was outside the house the entire time, does that mean John O'Keefe was outside the house the entire time? The prosecution would say yes.
And the defense is going to argue, well, the radius of those pings shows that there could be a possibility that maybe he went into the house for a very short period. It would have to be between pings, basically, which are pretty tight. So he would have had to go in for that short period of time. I think the longest is like 11 minutes, like between pings, and go from the spot where he was initially in the yard, goes in the house, and then somehow he's back at the spot in the house. If that happened, if it was between pings and he was able to do that, and for some reason they murdered him in those few minutes, or somebody did, and then decided, let's go put him exactly where he got out of the car at, maybe? I mean, because if he wasn't laying dead in the yard, he would have just been hanging out in the yard, I guess, for a while, and then went in the house for 11 minutes and then went back to the yard. Again,
I don't know how the defense is going to field this. Now, there was some cross-examination, and the defense did kind of muddy the waters, and they were able to get the expert to say, is it possible that the phone was inside the house during this larger interval of time at some point? The prosecution's expert kind of acquiesced to that and said, yeah, it's possible, based on sort of the radius and the diagrams that they did. I don't know if defense might argue, like, hey, did John O'Keefe drop his phone outside but still go in, and that's why the phone is cold, but John O'Keefe was actually inside? But we're getting to a place that's kind of convoluted and probably hard for a jury to believe.
We're getting to ridiculous territory. We really, and the prosecution is spelling this out 10 times better than Lally did in round one. He is painting an emotional picture, and he's painting, I think, a familial picture for most of the jurors in this part of the country, where people go out, it's cold, they drink. I'm from Wisconsin. It's what they do. It is part of the culture there, and it's part of the culture here, clearly. And this is just normal life. And he's talking about, yeah, you know, you go out with your friends. It's somebody's birthday. The family, the friends get together. That reminds me of my childhood. People, this is completely familial to me. And I think, okay, I can totally see all of this happening. We see the waterfall. There's nothing that happened there. There's no fights. Everybody's in a good mood. Everybody is even texting when they eventually do leave the Alberts' house about what a good time they had that night. There's even compliments about Karen in some of those texts. So nobody's like, nudge, nudge, what a good time. Karen's great, isn't she? She's going to go down, that bitch. Like, none of that is happening from these people the night of the actual event. And then we get to the morning. We get to the phone calls from Karen to Carrie and to Jennifer McCabe. Let's start with by listening to the information that Carrie Roberts has portrayed to the jury with her testimony. We'll talk on the other side.
Karen pointed out and said, look, my taillight. And I said, she said, do you think I hit him? And I said, no, I don't think you hit him. What are you talking about? Let's just go find him. But the taillight itself, the piece was missing. And as you got closer, there's a metal sort of square, and one of the pieces was sort of sticking out. And I only remember it because I thought if someone walks by that, they're going to catch their jacket on it.
How long of a time did you have to actually look at the taillight?
Under a minute.
How close were you to the taillight when you looked at it?
I was in front of it. I could see.
And when you talked about the taillight, you said a piece was missing. Is this the left side or the right side of the Lexus that you saw the piece of the taillight missing?
It was the right side, so it was the passenger taillight.
May I approach?
Yes.
She's pretty knowledgeable here on what she was seeing.
Should I remain, Your Honor?
Sure.
Thank you. Recognize what is in that photo?
That is Karen's SUV.
Is it similar or a fair and accurate depiction of how you saw the vehicle that morning?
Without the snow, I can't be positive, but this square piece was missing, as is in this picture.
The photograph you look at is not the car in the snow in the driveway the day you saw it.
Correct.
Putting that aside, is that a fair and accurate depiction of the damage that you saw to the right rear taillight of Ms. Reed's car that morning?
Yes.
And I think it's important to note, all of this is happening before they find John in the snow. So before anyone knows, and as Carrie even said, why would you think you hit him? You know, like, why were we, it's not even running through her mind that that's an option. She's thinking, you know, he's probably in someone's couch, whatever, but not going to, he's dead in the snow. Even when Karen brings up the taillight, that's still not in anyone's mind other than Karen. She says it a lot before they actually get to the scene where they find John O'Keefe. This, I think, is another quick piece, and then I want to get your reaction from Carrie Roberts talking about that initial phone call that came from
when she first called, Karen. She said, John's dead. Carrie, and hung up.
And she called you back.
She called back.
When she called back, was there any other party on the line other than you and her?
No.
What do you remember the second time that she called you?
Yes. She said, John, I think he got hit by a plow. He did not come home last night. He would never not have come home. I wasn't supposed to stay in Canton. And Kaylee was here. He would never leave Kaylee by herself.
Did anybody ever ask you to lie?
No.
Or exaggerate?
No.
Would you?
Say that?
Would you?
No.
Sustained.
You were asked whether or not you told people on January 29th about the missing pieces to the defendant's taillight. And you began to say you didn't tell anybody that morning.
I didn't think it had anything to do with John. I didn't want to point fingers at anybody.
Why not?
Because I had no idea what had happened to him. I wasn't going to point fingers at his girlfriend.
Was it, in fact, broken with missing pieces that morning?
Yes.
Feeling like a pretty credible witness there. So initially, I think a plow hit him. Okay. We don't know that Karen later says, I saw him go into the house, but she's thinking a plow hit him at this moment in time. This is going to be some mountains to climb for that defense. What's your thoughts here?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, you look at how Carrie, the witness, presents, like you said, incredible. She doesn't look like she's lying or searching for fabricated information. It's like she's just giving the answers to the best of her recollection. And on top of that, what she talks about is the idea that John got hit by something. That originates with Karen, and it originates when she says, I think he got hit by a plow. And then at another time, she says something like, you know, could I have hit him or did I hit him or something to that effect. Coming from Karen, that shows a consciousness of guilt. There could have been a million things that happened to this guy, but the fact that Karen's mind and her mouth goes immediately towards John O'Keefe getting hit by something shows a consciousness of guilt, according to prosecution.
I mean, that's sure what it looks like, because we go from it's a plow to I left him at the waterfall and we had an argument. Two things that we know one's not true. She didn't leave him at the waterfall and there was no fighting at the waterfall. So we know that's not true. Could there have been fighting in the car? Sure. But it certainly didn't happen at the waterfall when everybody left together. And then obviously she ends up saying that she saw him go in the house and everything was good. Let's go back to the plow and all of this, because it does seem to show a consciousness of guilt. She's immediately that morning saying, according to the witnesses, I think I hit him. I hit him. Every variation of it. Before they find John O'Keefe, and she's going to also the snowplow. So there's this thought that somehow he is still outside, that he never got into the house. Okay, that doesn't make any sense, though. If she says she saw him get into the house, why would you be worried that you hit him or a snowplow hit him if you saw him walk into the house and never came out, as Karen's story is right now? How are they going to argue this?
You know, it's a really important point, and I think it's in part a function of, like you said, just how well the prosecution is putting on their case this second time around. They're prepared for the defenses. They know what defense is going to say. And so they've done a good job at sort of preempting that and showing how, hey, what defense is arguing couldn't possibly have happened based on Karen Reed's statements at the scene, based on the witness's observation of the taillight. That undermines the defense's conspiracy theory that, you know, some rogue officer was messing with the taillight at some later time. And that's why it looks like the vehicle hit John O'Keefe. No, it looks like, sounds like the taillight was damaged from the very outset of this whole thing.
Would the jury buy, okay, taillight, she's just putting the pieces together. She's confused. She was drunk too at that moment in time. And she sees that her taillight is broken and she doesn't know where John is. So that must be the logical conclusion that, and that's just all theoretical. She's just saying that over and over because she's scared. She's afraid that this is what happened to John. It's not because it's what she saw happen to John. She's just putting pieces together and her mind is kind of foggy. So she's just in fear. Will a jury believe that? Because they're also going to see that she was arguing the night before and saying, I think you're sleeping with another woman. So why isn't Karen's reaction in the morning, he didn't come home because he's in some other woman's bed or at someone else's couch? Or if he got into the party, why wouldn't she be thinking he's just passed out there because he's not answering his phone? You go to, he's dead in the street. That's quite a jump.
It is significant points, Tony. You know, I think, like you said, defense is going to argue that, hey, this was chaotic. Karen was under so much emotional distress. She's trying her best to convey, you know, the information she has and how it could piece together in some fashion. And on top of that, she had to have a mental health examination shortly after this. She was really in shambles emotionally, and she's just trying her best to, you know, make suggestions as to, you know, connect dots and that kind of thing. But the dots she is connecting, according to the prosecution, kind of prove her guilt and establish the story that she hit John O'Keefe with her vehicle. And so, you know, of all the things she could have said and tried to piece together, why did she pick the one that goes directly to her guilt?
I think we're getting pretty close to vehicular manslaughter being proven here. I mean, for a while there, I was kind of thinking, I don't know if there's enough to quite get her on that, but I feel like there probably is at this point. I mean, there's a hair of his on the, you know, the light itself. Everyone can interpret, you know, bodily injury in different ways on this. Of it, was it a vehicle strike? Was it not? I mean, yeah, there's different interpretations there. But I think we're almost to that point, if we're not already past it. But we're really kind of getting closer to second degree murder because we're showing consciousness that he's outside and she has this knowledge before they actually find him in the snow. And I know they're going to go, well, like I just said, maybe this, maybe that, but how else are you going to have that knowledge? How else are, I mean, whether it's like right there consciously or not, or just a really bad feeling that something bad happened last night and I forgot it or pushed it away and here it is coming back.
Yeah, Tony, I think that the vehicular homicide charge was the strongest to begin with, in part because my reading of that charge doesn't require Karen Reed to even have known that she made contact with John O'Keefe. My reading of it is that so long as Karen Reed was drunk and driving and caused the death of another person through those actions, that's pretty much it, man. And so vehicular homicide is looking pretty darn favorable for the prosecution right now. And like you said, I think we're inching towards the second degree murder. I think the second degree murder is a higher bar, of course, and requires sort of a higher mental state and perhaps some intentionality or at least volitional conduct. And so we'll see if we get there.
Yeah, I'm really wondering if we're going to get there. And the thing is, all of this, every single piece of this, all preventable in terms of anybody getting this far, because I mean, this is just testimony from these two. In Karen's own words, she talks about, yeah, I was saying this, I was saying that. And she's still giving interviews. Like to this day, she's still giving interviews with Alan Jackson by her side to like local television and stuff. And it's not coming across good. What is going on here with this defense of Karen Reed? I mean, is this more of a publicity fest now for the attorneys? Or are they actually trying to defend Karen Reed? Because it feels like they're really up against a wall. And the more Karen opens her mouth, the deeper her hole gets.
It's hard to get a read on why defense counsel is permitting this to go on because, like you said, Karen Reed is outside of the courtroom steps almost every day having, heated exchanges about the facts of this horrible death of John O'Keefe. And she's not always coming off great. And she's not always consistent. And sometimes she's saying things that could be used against her. And so why in God's name do we allow her to keep doing that? Is it some sort of benefit to the attorneys? I have no idea. But gosh, if I was counsel on that, I would ratchet that up immediately. And there would be no public statements until the end of the trial because it's just too risky.
I don't know why they keep letting her speak or just say when she gets out of court, shut up. You're not, the jury is not the 8 Karen Reed supporters that are left in front of the courthouse wearing their pink shirts. The jury is in the courtroom. So her going out and making her smug remarks every single day, I don't know what the hell they're thinking. This does not look good. It certainly rallies them up because they're going to believe that the family, all these friends and family, went down to the corpse of John O'Keefe and put their phone in front of him to unlock it for some reason. It's just, it's getting completely laughable at this point. And you can believe that maybe Karen Reed is factually innocent if you don't think there's enough evidence lining up to prove that she actually hit him or that she is completely innocent without believing the whole story of he got beat up in the house and all these people conspired against him. You don't need that for that to exist.
But the more they keep going down that road, the more it just, in my opinion, it seems to make them look like they're making a lot of shit up. And if you're making a lot of shit up, the jury's going to go, what else are they making up? I'm going to convict her on all the counts because it seems like they're really making things up. And if they weren't making all this up over here, I think he got a much better chance of maybe her getting acquitted or just, you know, manslaughter. This does not seem to be playing well for Karen at this point.
Totally. It looks super shady, Tony. And gosh, that's the last way you want to look in front of a jury who's deciding your fate in a homicide case. You know, there are other defenses that could have been considered. You know, perhaps Karen Reed drove away and John O'Keefe was wasted or intoxicated. I don't mean to speak poorly about him, but I'm just saying in theory,
yeah.
He could have slipped and hit his head and something like that. There are a number of different avenues defense could have explored that are not. John O'Keefe went into this house full of cops and they were his friends and they killed him and then staged this cover up and framed Karen Reed. That's just a far-fetched leap that I'm not sure the jurors are prepared to make.
Let's watch a little bit of The Cross with Alan Jackson. And I want to get your opinion of how he's coming across to the jury, the way he is handling the witness. This is a little bit longer clip, but let's take a
look. I don't need to see my transcript. I know what I know, and I know what I remember. So
that's not my question. I'm not asking what you remember now. I'm asking how you testified a year ago now.
Whether I said it was as we're fighting over silly words, whether I said I got out of the car, are we there?
Words matter. They matter a lot.
Okay, so remember, Mr. Jackson, no comments. Ms. McKay, tell you to answer his question.
Okay.
Do you remember exactly how it is that you testified last year?
I do not, no.
May I approach?
Yes.
Thought we clipped that part out, but I'm going to move forward in this.
But it's a little bit different than what you stated.
Justified in substance.
Let me just give some context here, too. This is Alan Jackson.
I see what it says, I said, but it's a little bit different than what you stated.
Arguing with her about what the way she phrased getting out of the car and whether she basically inserted the words, and then I walked towards him and then saw Karen Reed, or omitted the part of walking towards him and just got right to the point of when I saw Karen Reed. We're literally arguing over the semantics of if she put that into the context of the sentence of I moved closer and then saw him or just saw them immediately. And I don't know where this is going.
Then let's walk through that. Did you indicate last year that as you got out of the vehicle, that's when you could see what Miss Reed was doing with John O'Keefe, down to the detail of pulling her shirt up and pulling his shirt up to try to go skin to skin?
I object.
Why don't I see it side by side? Why don't you bring it to Mr. Jackson, please?
And then we got more sidebar. But the badgering here of her just, it doesn't seem like it's coming off well.
Last year on this subject, answer, I was on the passenger side, so as I got out, she was already at John. Question. So she gets out and essentially makes a beeline over to where John was. Answer. Correct. Question. And you're getting out of the passenger side, and by the time you come around the car, she's already there. Answer. Yes.
And they're in a state of panic and shock at this moment in time, too. I mean, what? I don't know how this is gotcha moment. How do you think it's reading to a jury?
Bro, who cares? These are nitpicky, irrelevant, frivolous differences or alleged differences. You know, as a defense attorney, sometimes you lose the forest for the trees and you're, you know, you jump on something. Oh, she said something different last time, but does it really matter if there was a difference? It doesn't matter to waste the jury's time to talk about that and potentially come off as a jerk to the witness. That's not a win.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it feels like it's coming across right now. And it was painful watching this because it's like, come on, like this,
less is more here. You know, he thought he's going to go in there and really nail Jen McKay, but she's holding her own. This is Jackson trying to get her on talking about what was happening, who she was talking to in the fog of war. So John's there. He's on the ground. They realize he's probably dead. Jen McCabe is trying to maintain some sanity here and tell people what she's seen and what's going on. And again, Jackson really grilling her on little technicalities that don't matter. Let's take a look at this.
Again, I think all the phone call, all the conversations were about what was happening in the present time.
And literally, this was a couple of hours after this incident, correct? When everything was freshest in your mind.
These conversations were at the scene when Miss Reed was running around screaming.
Were you also interviewed by Officer Mullaney?
Again, there were many officers there that I spoke to.
Miss McCabe, do you understand my question? Do you understand the last question that I asked you?
If I spoke to an Officer Mullaney?
Correct.
Again, I could have. I am not sure. I don't remember every officer. It was a chaotic scene. I had just found my friend on the ground.
So the answer is, I don't remember. Correct?
I don't remember speaking to
anyone.
That's
what she said.
Sorry.
Later that morning, you did have a conversation with Officer Lang. You actually do remember, correct?
Yes, correct.
What you told Officer Lang, or Sergeant Lang, was that you received a phone call from Kaylee's phone and that Karen Reed was distraught because John never came home, correct?
I told him she was, I don't remember the exact words, but I told him something like she was hysterical and screaming and said John never came home.
You never mentioned that she said anything about a fight during that initial phone call, correct?
Again, I'm not sure what exactly was said during that initial phone call.
So he's trying to like catch her, like trying to concoct the conspiracy in the scene of finding John O'Keefe and then keep her story straight or something. They better be relying that nobody on this jury has ever been in a traumatic situation where they had to call police or had to do something because, yeah, you don't necessarily sit there. Well, let me give you every single thing that they talked about that night. You're not doing that in that moment. You're just trying to save your friend's life and get to some basic information out. It's not sit down and have a deposition time. And he knows that, but I mean, does he think the jury is that stupid?
You know, of course, Tony. And on top of that, there's kind of a tactical approach to consider. So look, when you're dealing with a police officer or an expert witness, it's okay to be aggressive and edgy and push them and stuff like that. But when you're dealing with just a simple witness whose friend died and went through this traumatic scenario where the friend is outside freezing to death in the cold, it doesn't make sense to be so insensitive, to be so harsh in your cross-examination with her. The jury's going to be like, what are you doing to this lady? You know, she didn't ask to be here.
He's a good attorney, too. Like, is he too close? Is he too close to this case where it's just like he is not seeing how this is looking to everyone else in the room, including the jurors?
You know, it's easy to kind of get that tunnel vision. And when you're preparing for a case and you're in the defense war room and you're in the echo chamber and everyone's agreeing with you and you're getting all rah-rah and psyched up about it, you can get lost in that. Yeah. And sometimes that causes you to be detached from the way that other people are feeling and how they're perceiving what you're doing in the courtroom. And so you've got to maintain a check on that and be mindful of that because you can take it too far and really rub the jury the wrong way.
I mean, if they're only listening to their own echo chamber right now over in the Free Karen Reed camp, I'm not talking if you just think she's innocent, but the Free Karen Reed camp where they're wearing the pink shirts and think the dog, you know, did something to him. It's like two totally different worlds. It's like they're watching a different trial than other people over here who are being more objective. And I think each side can go to such an extreme, but it's just amazing how people are not seeing
really like what is going on directly in front of them. Let's watch one more clip on this, and I have one more question for you. This is how court wrapped up the other day before they had a break on a Thursday. Let's take a look at
there are this. Certain things I will never forget, Mr. Jackson.
Including the fact that you never, ever, ever said, she said, the words I hit him to a grand jury when you were asked about it 3 months after this.
She said, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him.
You never told that to the grand jury, did you?
I don't remember specifically that every grand jury and everything I said, but I can tell you with 100% accuracy, she screamed, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him.
And you never said that to the grand jurors.
I don't recall if I did.
You were there to get the truth, correct?
The truth is, she said, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him.
You were asked that specific question at the grand jury. What did she say at the scene in front of the female EMT? And you know what your answer was? You do, because you just read it.
I wasn't asked what she was said
what
at the
was
scene.
The answer to that question?
I'm objecting.
The objection sustained. Ask one more clear question, Mr. Jackson.
What was the answer you gave in answer to the question about what was said by Ms. Reed to the EMT, the female EMT at the scene? What did you say she said?
I don't know if I was asked specifically what she said to a female EMT.
All right, we're going to end this now.
Your Honor, may I have one more question?
Go ahead.
I can't end it like this.
Ignore the comments of counsel. Ask one question, Mr. Jackson.
Literally shut down by the judge like a petulant child. I just want one more cookie. One more thing to say. Did Alan Jackson go out that night and feel confident, like, I'm nailing this? Or, like, is it a nail, like, nailed it? Like, I really nailed it? Or, like, one of those where you make something that you saw online and it turns out nothing like it's supposed to be, nailed it?
You know, hard to say, but from a defense perspective, what's the last thing you want in front of the jury repeatedly over and over again to talk about repeatedly? That's Karen Reed's alleged statement. I hit him, I hit him, I hit him. And Alan Jackson's approach is allowing Jennifer McCabe to repeat that over and over to the jury. I hit him, I hit him, I hit him. That's horrible evidence for the defense. And he should have shut it down and locked it up. Instead, he let it happen.
It's like
and contributed to it happening.
He gave her a second chance to like reinforce everything she said the first day. What are you doing? This is working out better for the prosecution with your line of questioning, I think, even than the prosecution's line of questioning. It was just shockingly a train wreck. But there's a lot to come. The defense, they still have their turn. We haven't gotten to the Proctor world of things yet. They, you know, probably need to hope that that's going to land pretty well, because there's a lot of character issues there. But I wouldn't say this is going as well as they planned thus far. Do you think this is where they want it to be in terms of the defense of Karen Reed?
I think it's going much more poorly to the defense at this stage than the first trial had been going at this stage. And I think that they don't have a lot of, you know, bombshells to drop. There's the Trooper Proctor thing, but does that really go to guilt or innocence? That's
it
questionable.
Doesn't.
And then there's the dog bite thing. Does that really align with their conspiracy that John O'Keefe was killed by people inside the house? Not really. And so I don't know what else they have up their sleeve. I'll be interested to see, but better have something good.
They better.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.